Okay, so let's start. Just, hopefully I don't want to take up too much of your time, obviously. So I'll try not to ask too many questions. But I think obviously the first thing people would want to know is a little bit about yourself and how you decided to become a scientist and, a little bit about your journey to the point at which you are at now.
So I grew up in the United Kingdom. I've always been sort of slightly more scientifically than artistically inclined. Around the time I was a college student, HIV was becoming a significant problem. I was studying biochemistry at college. In the UK, you're sort of forced to specialize a little bit earlier than most people in the United States would recognize. But throughout my time as a college, undergraduate college student, viruses and HIV in particular were becoming an increasing part of people's lives, an increasing part of what people worried about. There had been a previous view that infectious diseases was a problem of the past, and we really didn't have to worry about them anymore. But the HIV pandemic really laid to rest that erroneous idea. So, as I approached graduation, there actually were a number of opportunities to get involved in HIV research. And that was something that struck me both as interesting and important, a real fundamental challenge that needed to be tackled. And so that's what drew me into becoming a scientist and more particularly a virologist. So I did a PhD on a group of viruses called retroviruses. They're called that simply because of the particular way that they replicate, and HIV is one of that group of viruses. I did my PhD in the UK, and then became time to consider seriously what my career would be. And I loved doing science, right? There's just this thrill of finding out things that nobody else knows, that captured me, I think, during the course of my PhD years. And still to this day, although perhaps not going forward, the United States was widely regarded, with great justification, as the place in the world that one needed to go to train at the highest levels to be a scientist. The amount of resources devoted to science, the sort of it's difficult to put this into words, the rather natural way that the spirit of entrepreneurship, innovation, that sort of character for an outsider seems to characterize America, the way that dovetails with the mindset that you need to do scientific discovery, is perhaps the underlying reason why there are more resources devoted to science in the United States, why many, many people from around the world want to come to America to train to become a scientist. We had a little phrase in the UK. So many of the senior scientists in the UK would make use of this phrase. It's this qualification. It's called a BTA. BTA stands for Been to America, right? That means coming to the United States to complete at least part of your training, either as a graduate student or as a postdoc. Virtually all of the leading labs in the world were in the United States. So I picked a few to apply to, was successful in becoming a postdoctoral scientist in a lab in the United States. And that essentially put me on the track to becoming an American scientist. I came to America without a clear idea whether I would want to stay or return to my home country, having trained in the United States. But life takes over. I met my wife, who was actually also a European who wanted to come to America to train. She came to America to train around the time I was finishing my postdoc and establishing my own lab. So we set up our lives together here in the United States. We have American children. And that was essentially the path that led me to become an independent investigator studying viruses in the United States. And so it has been for around close to 25 years now. I've run a lab for the most part studying HIV and retroviruses. The pandemic caused us to take a turn that was, I think, somewhat naturally approaching us anyway to broaden our repertoire into other viruses. And SARS-CoV-2 was, of course, a catastrophic pandemic.
That brings actually to the next question, which is, of course, you know, what you guys are working on generally now in your lab and what projects are very exciting to you at the moment.
We have a mixture of work now. Some are based on work that we've been interested in a while, for a long period of time on HIV. We study various aspects of HIV biology. Historically, we've done a lot of work on how virus particles assemble. We're probably best known for our work on discovery of genes that provide protection against viral infection. Many of those genes have been discovered using HIV. They provide barriers to HIV infection that the virus has to evolve to overcome, and it does so by acquiring new biological functions, accessory genes, and sort of the discovery of those antiviral genes and the virus countermeasures to them has been a large part of where we work. Not everything we've done, but a large part of what we work on. So that general aspect of host defense underpins a large part of our work. When the pandemic came along, it was, I think, pretty clear to us, and obviously not just us, to many people, that how our immune system reacted to this new threat would be in large part what would dictate how the outcome of the pandemic. And so we set up a program in collaboration with B-cell biologists here to study neutralizing antibodies, to develop medicines based on neutralizing antibodies, to try to make vaccines, better vaccines than we currently have, to protect against emerging SARS-CoV-2 variants, as well as the coronaviruses that lurk in nature. Part of our work during the pandemic, in fact, showed how the selective pressure imposed by antibodies was what was driving the emergence of new variants. We were among the first to demonstrate that the virus was acquiring resistance to the first generations of antibodies that humans were making in response to infection and later vaccination. And so that evolutionary to and fro between SARS-CoV-2 and antibodies has its sort of parallels in what we'd previously been studying over longer evolutionary time periods as retroviruses adapt to the host defenses that would otherwise protect us against infection against those viruses had they all not evolved to acquire resistance.
I'm sort of curious because I personally don't work on a topic that's sort of at all controversial. So, you know, I'm curious how working on something that's so in the popular news and has so many opinions from different types of people, how does that impact, you know, the research that you do and any sort of directions that you take things into?
On a day-to-day basis, in terms of decisions about experiments that we do in the lab, the controversy or the opinions of public about those issues has virtually no influence. You know, science has its truths and untruths, that we determine the accuracy of those truths or untruths by doing experiments. Opinions don't really matter that much. Obviously, we have opinions that influence, in a sense, the hypotheses that we have in terms of designing experiments, but those things aren't really colored by what's popular or controversial, right? Or at least we endeavor that they are not influenced in that respect. When we're designing an experiment, it's basically the results of the previous experiment that tell you what the next experiment's going to be, not what some person on the news believes is true or not true. And very often it's very far removed from reality.
Yeah. And is there something you wish that the lay public would know about your research that you feel they don't fully grasp or understand, or even that they just haven't heard it because people don't talk about it?
About my research particularly, I think it's a little bit technical for that to be a real worry. There is one issue that has assumed a large part of the public consciousness that I really don't feel that the public have been well informed or well equipped to evaluate. And this is the whole basis of whether the virus originated in a laboratory or originated in nature. The bottom line is that the evidence isn't absolute in either direction or the other, but it is so heavily weighted, in my opinion, to a natural origin rather than a lab leak, that it almost doesn't bear discussing, right? And this is why terms like conspiracy theory arose early in the pandemic. I kind of still think of the lab leak thing as a conspiracy theory. Part of that is based on half a lifetime's experience of understanding viruses. And it gives, that experience does give you sort of what other people would call preconceptions. I would call intuition based on knowledge. Right. So intuition is really sort of a subconscious assessment of quantitative probabilities of something being correct or incorrect. And I think having studied viruses for 30 years gives me an intuition that it's difficult for me to explain every detail to every member of the public why I think it's a natural origin. The virus came from nature and not from a laboratory. I could go through every piece of evidence, every thing I've encountered in a 30-year career that leads me to that conclusion, but we'd be here for a very long time. And that isn't something that's very easy to communicate to members of the public. And so it sort of comes across as me almost saying, trust me, I know what I'm talking about. That isn't exactly it, but I do wish that it was possible to have a better discussion about these complicated and controversial issues. But sometimes it just isn't possible. It does require that very deep technical knowledge to come up with what I think is a reasonable conclusion.
I think this gets to a broader issue of trust, and there definitely somehow seems to be a decreasing level of trust in scientists. I mean, probably not just in the US. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on where that distrust comes from and what we can do other than things like this to try and gain that trust back.
Yeah, I do have some thoughts about that. they might not be very palatable to everyone. It may not be palatable to my colleagues, in fact. It is true that that academia, the environment that scientists occupy, is quite heavily swayed to the left side of the political spectrum. That should be irrelevant to scientific conclusions, right? Unfortunately, that hasn't always been the case. And I think increasingly, people do allow their politics to color their scientific opinions, right? Without going into sort of specific details about specific issues, we sort of know as scientists what's true and what isn't true. Yet we are sometimes reluctant to say those things because we're surrounded by people of particular political persuasions that are friends and colleagues, right? And maintaining good relationships with those people, I think, sometimes causes us to not speak out about issues that we might or might not feel strongly about. And it becomes very easy for the general public to have a view of scientists that is portrayed by a rather small minority of us who are prepared to speak vociferously about issues they care very deeply about.
I think this is an interesting point because, you know, at least in my experience, having been to a major, you know, as an undergrad in a major U.S. institute, and I mean, I think at least among the academic disciplines, scientists probably have the largest proportion of, you know, right-leaning or at least, you know, not completely left-wing makeup. And certainly, you know, although I had many humanities courses where professors inserted their political opinions, I can't really ever remember that being true in a science course. And I think there's some conflation about academia as a whole that is maybe now being sort of put onto scientists because we receive so much of the funding when at least scientists are not perhaps as much of the so-called problem that people are identifying.
Yes. So, I, you know, one issue that springs immediately to mind is, you know, how different are males and females, right? And we know as biologists that, you know, there are basically two sexes, right? And
of course,
that if you have sporting events that where people who have grown up male and through a deep inner conviction decide that they want to be female, if those two groups are allowed to compete together, that isn't going to be a fair competition. To me as a scientist, that shouldn't be an issue of huge societal importance, but it's assumed. It's become a sort of an avatar, I don't know the right words to put on it, but something that we seem to devote a huge amount of time and effort to fighting over, where the facts of the situation are pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the issue that I see, which is now a little far removed from your research, but is, you know, that I saw a few weeks ago that the administration had archived the policy on sex as a biological variable, which in theory is should be exactly what we want, right? We want to study phenomena in both sexes because the fact is they are different and we need to know what those differences are. And somehow these issues have become so convoluted that now they're deciding that anything that has the word sex in it is a forbidden research topic, which right. should be the opposite of what we want, I think.
Yes. Yes. Sex is a biological variable, right? What it might be simple to say sex is a biological variable, gender is not, right?
Yes. So now, like, let's circle back if we can. So how is this, you know, current administration and climate impacting your research? Is it impacting it? And, you know, what do you feel about those?
So, gosh, where to begin? So in very specific, direct terms, as you may know, one of our grants has been terminated. Essentially, the view of the administration is the pandemic is over, and so we no longer need to do research on coronaviruses. The problem with that specific issue is that while our work was, the impetus for our work came from the pandemic, our work isn't really about the pandemic as a historical entity. It's about preparing for the next pandemic. Okay? If we don't sort of learn the lesson of what has transpired over the past 5 years, we're not going to be any better prepared the next time there's a pandemic, as there inevitably will be. And so in our specific case, we were attempting to understand how B cells make antibodies that recognize perhaps a broader array of antigens than they ordinarily would do, and trying to manipulate vaccine components to stimulate as wide array of antibodies as possible to maximize the possibility that the sorts of immune evasion that we saw during the previous pandemic would be less of a problem. And ideally, and this was the ultimate goal, was to have a vaccine or set of vaccines that would be on the shelf and ready to protect against the majority of coronavirus threats that exist in nature.
For the lay audience, could you just explain what immune evasion means?
Okay. So when we experience a viral infection or we receive a vaccine, one of the key components of our reaction, our immune response to that, is a generation of antibodies. These are molecules that bind to components of the vaccine or a virus that infects us and essentially either stop that virus from being able to attach to target cells and replicate, or recognize infected cells and kill those infected cells. Essentially, the role of antibodies is to act as inhibitors of viral infection. So they work by directly binding to bits of the virus, usually the outer part of the virus, what we call the spike protein. If they're successful in blocking viral infection, that puts an evolutionary pressure on the virus to change, and change very specifically at the part of the virus where the antibody binds. And that, in a nutshell, is what immune evasion is. The mutations or changes in the virus that cause those antibodies to not bind or bind much less well than they otherwise would leads to survival of viruses that lack the ability to be recognized by those antibodies. And so what the goal of our project was to make antibodies that make it much more difficult for the virus to acquire mutations that would cause them to not be bound by antibodies. And the way one does that is to try and make antibodies that bind very tightly, antibodies where the binding is so tight that the acquisition of mutations at the binding site isn't sufficient to knock that antibody off, to make antibodies that recognize parts of the virus that are much more difficult for it to change while maintaining fitness. And then the third part is to make as wide a range of antibodies as possible to create a larger number of challenges for the virus to overcome, to evade the whole set of antibodies that we make confronting it. And so immune evasion is really the ability to evade the sets of antibodies that we make. And our job as scientists, vaccinologists in this particular regard, is to make antibodies that are as difficult for the virus to evade or escape as possible.
So I guess this is similar to the flu and why there are new flu vaccines every year.
Absolutely. And so, you know, SARS-CoV-2, as well as being a disastrous event for humanity, is actually an important scientific opportunity. It's essentially the first time in, while we've had modern scientific tools, that nearly everybody in the world was exposed to nearly the same antigen at around the same time. That is an incredible scientific opportunity to understand how immune systems respond to a particular virus. And then we were able to watch in real time as the virus evolved resistance to those first generations of antibodies. And so it sets up a very useful model system that we can study in the lab to understand more generally how viruses evade antibodies and what we might do to defeat that evasion. And that knowledge, in principle, could be quite widely applicable to things like flu, even HIV. HIV is a tougher challenge, but there are a whole range of viruses that have varying degrees of ability to escape our immune systems. And so understanding the dynamics, the evolutionary to and fro of those processes has implications well beyond what we've just gone through.
It brings me to a sort of philosophical question that I have, which is that, you know, the topics that you study are obviously very relevant to human health. And, you know, for me, it's sort of interesting because I did training at Rockefeller, where the motto is science for the benefit of humanity. And now I work at a Max Planck, where the motto is curiosity-based science. And there's a, you know, let's say not competing, but two different philosophies, where science is something that, you know, you do because you have a goal for, you know, improving human health or human experience in mind, and more science that is just trying to understand more about how the world works, whether or not that has a direct benefit that we see. And it seems, you know, clear that at least this administration has a priority for efficiency, reducing waste. And so I'm curious how you see these two different philosophies and whether the curiosity-based science, because I think even for those of us that are studying topics that do have direct, you know, relationships to human health, we also, as you said, have, as scientists, have this thrill of discovery. And so perhaps not every single question that we're interested in is going to have a direct impact right away. And so how do you think of these two different philosophies, and how, what's the optimal way to go about science?
Right. It's a very interesting and actually, I'd say, crucially important question. There is, you know, a natural human tendency to want to aspire to efficiency and aspire to do things that will be important in the foreseeable future. But that's a a very sort of short-sighted view. Attempts to legislate efficiency into the scientific process are almost doomed to failure because of the unpredictable nature of what comes out of science, the huge role, the enormous role that serendipity plays in the scientific process. So, you know, between the two of us, we could probably come up with 1,000 examples of things that are of crucial biomedical importance today or will be tomorrow that couldn't possibly have been known in advance. I'm going to pick one example because it's one that your audience probably will have heard of, and this is CRISPR, right? This is a tool that every scientist working with the animal cells to genetically manipulate them in the lab for experimental purposes uses this technique, and it's quite likely this technique will be used in the not very distant future to treat diseases in humans. This all came from some curious person looking at the DNA sequence of obscure bacteria and seeing certain sequences appear to be repeated for no particular reason, right? And it was that initial observation that was the first step in understanding an immune system that bacteria have to protect themselves against viruses. And it has certain components of it that can be changed, manipulated, put together in useful ways that allow us to now engineer in exquisite specificity and detail the genomes of cells in the laboratory and ultimately in people for use as a scientific tool and treat people of all manner of diseases. There's no possible way that you can get from that first step to that last step anticipating what that initial observation would have been. That's just one example, but if you look at, I would say, I actually can't think of a number, but a large fraction of the medicines that we take today, if you go back, you will find they have their roots in some totally unexpected experimental observation that led to a discovery that of some fundamental import, some fundamental aspect of biology whose importance probably wasn't immediately recognized. So the way I like to think of it is that science, in its most fundamental form, just builds a base of knowledge. And it's a base of knowledge that on which you can draw from to build things like medicines and tools. But if we're thinking about, a therapy that's going to cure a particular cancer 20 years from now, the medicine that's going to do that hasn't been discovered yet. Its mechanism of action probably isn't yet known. And that's going to be experiments probably that are going on now in some lab where the motivation is just curiosity. They're not even thinking about curing cancer 20 years from now. So a healthy scientific ecosystem has to have the applied research, but it doesn't exist in isolation. You have to have a foundation of knowledge on which that's built, and that's the role of fundamental science. The problem that we face now is you could wipe away all of fundamental science. You're going to have no problem in the short term, but you will never know that your grandchild might die of a cancer whose cure never gets discovered because you did away with the fundamental science today. That's sort of the challenge and what we have to constantly remind ourselves of is that the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake is today pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. But at some point, some of that knowledge, and the problem is today you're not going to know which pieces of knowledge are going to be important, but some of them are going to be important.
Yeah. The example I always give is GLP-1s and Exendin 4, which comes from the venom of the Gila monster, which, like, who knew that studying venom of a random reptile is going to, you know, lead to such a profound clinical impact.
Absolutely.
I have one bonus question based off of that before we end, which is, if you think that AI is going to change how we do this process, and will it take away some of that creativity? You know, because I definitely hear suggestions from people that, we won't really need scientists to think up, to write grants in 10 years because, you know, generative AI is going to come up with all the new questions for us. But, you know, I think based on what you mentioned, it seems perhaps there's still room for creativity or just plain curiosity that's not predicted by what's been done in the past.
Yeah. So I must confess to being a little out of my element in terms of trying to predict what AI is going to do. I know today that it's quite a way off being able to replace scientists in terms of the creative aspect. It's very good at some things. It's an incredibly useful tool for writing code, or one of the things I like to do is as part of my work is design nucleotide sequences that encode for a protein, and I want to manipulate some aspect of them, and it does those routine things that make my brain hurt if I do them myself. It can do those things wonderfully well. I've tested some of the AI things in terms of design an experiment that will do this, right? And it's good repeating the general lines of experiments that have been done in the past, but it is not in any sense creative in the way that I understand creativity. That idea that's outside the box. I mean, AI almost by definition thinks inside the box, right? But we know the true revolutions in science have come from people who thought outside the box. And, you know, at least for the foreseeable future, I think AIs are going to be an incredibly useful tool, but it's going to need smart people to tell it what to do.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's it for my questions. If there's anything else that you just have a burning passion to impart to people about your research or any of the related topics.
Here. I don't think so. I think we've covered quite a lot of ground. I think, you know, the question you asked towards the end about the importance of fundamental science is very, very important. Perhaps I would add to that, and this sort of ties in a little bit to my own personal stories. We don't just have to look after science as sort of an institution, as a knowledge-making entity, but the people who do it. I mentioned in my own case, I was drawn to the United States because of the importance that science has in this culture. If we start to neglect, you know, doing fundamental science, if we try to see it as a process that can be done efficiently with limited funds, all those people that are motivated to pursue knowledge for its own end, all those people who might actually be very interested in the applied science, but see the United States as the place in the world to come to do science, that is going to be incredibly easy to lose if we try to, as this administration is doing, try to legislate efficiency into science. Part of scientists are people too, right? They want to be in places where the science is great, but they also want to have a good life as well. And so compensating scientists at an appropriate level, making their lives not a struggle every day to worry about, you know, where the next dollar is coming from to do an experiment. These are what in the past has separated American science from science that's done in countries where there's less of a commitment to that pursuit of knowledge. It's an incredibly valuable aspect of science in America, and we're in great danger of losing it, and losing it quickly, if we don't change the course that's been embarked on.
Agreed. Well, thank you so much.
Good.
Thank you for taking the time. I really
appreciate it. No problem. I enjoyed talking to you. I'm happy to do it.